You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. The sound of the show today is a little bit unusual. I'm taping in a dormitory of Downing College in Cambridge. I'm at the Cambridge Seminar on the Contemporary British Writer, sponsored by the British Council. And my first guest today is Jim Crace. His newest novel is Quarantine. His previous novels include Continent, which is actually a book of interrelated short stories, A Gift of Stones, Arcadia, and Signals of Distress. Many of them have been published in America in paperback as well as hardcover. Quarantine is to be published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Now, some of us already know of Quarantine because when John Updike reviewed the Norman Mailer book of the story of Jesus, he mentioned that the book really contemporary among many, including Reynolds Price's translations, to tell this story in both an imaginative and naturalistic way, to imagine a potential life of Jesus or such a figure, the book would be Quarantine by my guest Jim Crace. And I wanted to begin by asking you, the book seems to have an odd mixture of the possible and the farcical, actually, it seems to me. There is an odd sense in this book that miracles are a form of farce. And so when Jesus heals the first man he heals, he doesn't know he's doing it. The man is, in fact, a rotten, uncruel man whose first act is to arise and kill his lame donkey. Mm-hmm. And there's this funny feeling of miracle as ironic comedy here. Could you talk about that?
Well, maybe the supernatural world, including miracles, isn't as neat as we imagine it. Maybe miracles and the Christian religion and all religions are rather clumsier than we've imagined. And so the fact that Jesus' first unwitting miracle is to cure and bring back to life a satanic figure is irony, and it's satire, and it's a remark on the clumsiness of the Christian religion. And it also is a test of religion, isn't it? Because it's no triumph for Christ, if you believe in Christ and if you believe in miracles, to cure someone who's worthy. But for him to cure someone that is so unworthy that it's the devil figure in this book, somehow or other undermines Christianity by showing it to be a bit foolish, but also shows the strength of Christianity, that if it has got any forgiveness in its blind, foolish way, it will also forgive the devil.
Now, what we have here essentially are five caves to which penitents have come for 40 days apiece. These caves begin to have something of the rooms of a farce, the bedroom doors out of which people race in and out. And in fact, there is a moment in this book, almost terrifying to me, because it is born of the saddest kind of farce of all. A woman has come for 40 days to the desert because she believes, is infertile. The wife before her was infertile too. Ah, we begin to suspect. And she somehow doesn't know whether the naked man who's come into the cave is a dream or not. Mm-hmm. So we know before long that there will be a miraculous birth. And this is another way in which miracles happen, yes?
Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the Christian religion is based on the concept of a miraculous birth. We're asked to believe that Christ was immaculately conceived. And so my take is to come up with a version of a miraculous birth which will seem miraculous, but we will know as the reader, we will see the scaffolding of what is really happening. We will know that this child is the product of a rape, but there is enough uncertainty there for people who want to believe it to think that the child is the product of a religious visitation. and they can believe that and not seem foolish. And that's the centre of the thing, really, because, you know, as a rationalist atheist myself, a scientific atheist, so, on so many occasions the Christian religion just seems petty and talkative and foolish, and yet it still has great edifices that you can admire and wouldn't want to do without. And it's that ambiguity that this book inhabits.
Yes, the desire for belief. And in a certain sense, as a scientific atheist, you must at the same time be yearning for your book to have an effect at all, other than a dry effect of mere disgruntled disbelief. One must be seeking, as William James did when he wrote about the varieties of religious experience, one must be seeking for the possibility of why there is in fact so much belief. Mm. Not the truth of Jesus, but the case for the belief in Jesus.
Mm. Mm. Well, one of the clear things to me as a non-believer, and as I become more unforgiving in my lack of belief, is the fact that I still need to have a meditative and transcendental aspect to my life. And that is why I suppose that myself and other people who comment on religion through science, you know, Dawkins and such like, and Stephen Jay Gould and what have you, are people who adore the natural world. They're bird watchers and they're coast walkers, and it's because we take out of the natural world the sustenance that people who believe in God take out of the supernatural world, because our sense of the supernature is that the world is not an outside job done by God through creation, but it's an inside job done through nature. And if you start to believe that, then you start to believe that there's some kind of spirituality and element of faith even in atheism, that the new atheists kind of believe in the transcendental power of the landscape. So running parallel all of the time to this story that I'm writing is this eighth character — there are seven characters in the book — is this eighth character that is the scrub, the landscape itself, which in the end, in a way, is not — you're not struck on the head and told to pay attention to this, but in a way, the landscape is the thing which forms people's minds.
And this stay in the desert is called A Quarantine. That is the title of the novel by my guest, Jim Crace. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Now, I wanted to ask you about that, too, because in most senses, a person picking up this book immediately thinks of quarantine in our modern sense of sickness, mm-hmm. and in the sense of plague, and we're living in a modern and plague-ridden world. So I wanted to ask you about the choice of title.
Mm. Well, of course, in England it has that extra meaning that we're not allowed to bring our pets into Britain, and they have to go into 6 months yes. of quarantine. So everyone thinks it's one of these books about a dog lover's book. Well, it's a beautiful word, quarantine, because it has ambiguity to it. It means all of those tough things. It means going without. It means being isolated in the way that you've described. But it also represents the number 40. It represents 40 days. It also represents a lot of mythological stories, the 40 days, the 40 years of the crossing from Egypt, the 40 lashes that you get if you're part of the Jewish religion, the 40 days a body has to be buried before the final prayers are said over it. 40 is, for some reason or other that I don't understand and I can't hope to explain, has got a magical resonance to it. I could have called the book 40 Days.
But or
the
word, 40 Thieves.
40 Thieves, yeah. yes, they would have loved that, the publishers. But quarantine has a very ambiguous feel about it, and I don't like to give a title to my books which locates the meaning of the book entirely before you start reading it. Possibly because I don't know what the meanings of my books are myself, so I want to retain that element of uncertainty.
Now, you've spoken of yourself as a very practical man, a worker and a...
Well, I'm not a worker, but my background is working class, yeah.
Yes. And you've spoken of the novel writing as akin to flying a kite, yeah. as if there were a war between the currents of the carry the kite of the wind and of the person on the ground trying to navigate yeah. the kite. And it seems as if the success comes in a tie. A book that carries the novelist away would probably go over the tie. Mm-hmm. A kite flyer who wanted to maintain too strict control would end up with a rather dull kite day. Mm-hmm. You have to risk. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me that you begin these books, since one takes place on an imaginary continent, one takes place at the tail end of the Stone Age, at the beginning of the Brass Age. You begin these books by taking risks, and it would seem as if a man who wanted to bevel and be a pure craftsman, to know the limits of the art involved, would want to retain stricter control. Mm-hmm. Tell me why you let go from the very beginning.
I don't let go of the strings of the kite. In fact, if you read my books, you will see that they are immensely structured and tightly structured. If you stub your toe on a rock in chapter one, you know that that rock has a meaning and a place and a metaphorical place and a landscape place, and it will be revisited. Nothing is there by chance. These are meticulously planned books in one aspect. The way in which, for example, in quarantine, there are only three sites where things happen: the caves, the tent, and the cave where Jesus is. And it's almost balletic, the way in which the characters move from one to the other in a very, very patterned way. So they're schematic and they're patterned. So in one part, I have total control. Mm-hmm. I'm a clever kite flyer, is the image I hope to hold for myself, in control of those strings. But the element that I do let go free is the way in which the narrative develops, the way in which I choose the symbols are offered to me to select. And those come to me almost as a side product of telling stories. It's exactly the same feeling as when you're in a pub and you're telling the anecdote and it's going well, and you can feel all of the lines dropping in the right place, and you can hear the punchline coming in with the right emphasis, and you can hear the elaborations on the truth working well, and you've reshaped the truth into your perfect little story wonderfully well, and everyone's listening. It doesn't matter that they've heard the joke, the same joke earlier in the evening told by someone else, it didn't work. You're really on song. So that's something that people that don't write novels can enjoy. When I'm writing a novel and indulging in that for a year, then what I really want to do is to find that magic seam where the story is letting me swim in, you know, fly in the water and swim in the air, as it were. And I'm constantly being offered up delights that fit snugly into my tight structure. Hmm. So it's tight structure and freedom of imagination. And when those two things gel, by tea time, I'm a very happy man.
And I know that your early career took you to Africa. And it seems to me that the kind of spatial disorientation that you find in a brand new place, in a brand new people, with new plants, new animals, new geography, is one that you want for your books. You want to take the reader to a place that has not previously existed exactly. Was the African experience an origin for the kind of book you want to write?
I'm not sure. I think the African experience was a manifestation of my appetite for strange landscapes rather than the other way around. If I were affected by the African experience and also other experiences in South America and in Asia when I was a journalist, if I was actually influenced by those particular places, then they would show up as named places. They would be called the Sudan, they would be called Brazil, they would be called Indonesia. What is more likely is that my inner imaginative world was formed in this way before I ever travelled. In other words, when I was a kid, 6-7 years of age, I used to lay on my stomach for hours on end drawing the outlines of islands that didn't exist on the maps, or filling in continents that didn't exist. I've still got some of those things, and the detail of them is extraordinary and frightening. What I'm doing with this book is not trying to reproduce a real world, but to invent an abstraction of the real world and my own version of it. The book Quarantine is notionally set in Judea, but it's not set in any real Judea at all. You're not going to, if you went to Judea, you wouldn't find those places. If you read the detail of the plants, there are names of plants there that don't exist. The man has got a curly stick made out of tarbany. There's no such wood as tarbany. It's entirely my invention. There are birds mentioned there that do not exist. I made them up. So it's not an African experience that influences me or a traveller that experiences me. It's the nature of my private imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a very internalised person. I'm owning up now because I'm talking to people in America and my neighbours aren't going to hear. But in my neighbour's point of view, I'm the person that's a good gardener and I'm the father, I'm the person that walks the dog. They can't imagine how living in Birmingham, in this dull suburb, in this dull city, in this dull nation, works if this imagination can come out of that. And the reason that they don't realise it is that I never will give anybody a clue that I've got this sort of other active life. And this other active life is the part of me which is out of control, which is why I'm not a drinker, why I don't take drugs, why I'm not an adulterer. I've got this other thing which drains me, which is an active imaginative life and an out-of-control imaginative life. To write novels is to indulge it, but it's also to allow it expression. And that's what happens in these books. I feel a deep sense of satisfaction when I've finished a book because I've unloaded myself of the burden of another invented geography.
It's very interesting what you say, because Musa, the devil figure in this book, is also said to have a vestigial, unexplored life. Yeah. His life as a timid, easily hurt, vulnerable, and honest man.
Mm-hmm.
He learns to betray that life and to keep its existence a secret, yes?
Mm. I'm through telling stories as well, you
yes.
know. I mean, the great thing, the great Miltonic thing, that the devil's stories are better than Christ, and mm-hmm. and the devil has all the best songs. We both know those phrases.
Yes, and the other thing that we learn is that the devil, who is allowed, after all, to lie, can tell the better stories.
Mm-hmm.
Lying lets you mm-hmm. tell better stories. It's an unfortunate truth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm led to think about the line that Melville has when describing Queequeg's Island. He says, it's unforgettable, it is not found on any map. True places never are.
No,
yeah.
No, that's right. Yeah, and invisible cities as well. Calvino touches on exactly that issue, doesn't it? Yes.
No, it seems to me that to find places that correspond to one's inner life, well, for me, I did that by reading. You mm. know, the day that I found Invisible Cities, I was happy beyond belief. In fact, it was in Italy. I mm. didn't know Italian. I couldn't stand that a new Calvino existed without my ability to read it. So I sat there with a dictionary looking up these words which would turn out to mean chalcedony or camel hump or mm. orifice. Or, I mean, these extraordinary words. That was my first Italian. Mm. Because you always want, if you don't feel comfortable in, as you called it, the dull world, the dull nation, the dull garden, you always want a place that you feel safe in,
mm.
it seems to me.
But it's always, again and again, when you talk to people, it's always fiction. You've described it yourself. I describe it myself. That's what I'm trying to find out. I don't know the answers to. What is it about this strange moment when we sit down, you go through a park, there's someone cross-legged on the lawn, they've got a book open. And there's something where in which not only is this a moment of deep privacy, but it's almost also the moment where they're doing something which is the opposite of privacy, which is entering a huge world. What is it about that that is so magical? If those magic moments could be dished up by newspapers and by non-fiction books and by real geography or by a description of the Sudan or a description of Indonesia, then that's what we would be doing. The truth of the matter is that those rich moments only come from narrative, from fiction, from lies, from things that aren't true. Now, that can take you in two directions. That can make you believe that there's something wasteful and untrustworthy about all kinds of dishonesty, including fiction. Or it can tell you what I believe, that some of the most transcendental moments in our lives can be provided by lies and by things that aren't true. You felt that reading fiction. I feel that reading fiction. And when I write fiction, what I try and do is to impulse into that vein of storytelling which will elicit the kind of response that you're describing.
Yes, and it seems to me that what I particularly like about your books, although they are not long or short, they're comfortably medium length, they seem interested in distilling the essence of an imaginative experience. Hmm. I don't know exactly the words to put this, I can only describe it. I noticed once when I was reading a German fantasist, E.T.A. Hoffmann, I was reading a story called The Sandman, and he says, unlike the English Sandman, or more particularly the American one who puts children to sleep, that Sandman comes, and if he finds children awake, he plucks their eyes out. He plucks their eyes out, and he puts them in his sack,
mm-hmm.
and he flies with them to the moon, where he feeds them to the moon owls, who like to gnaw on children's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that, you see, in order to go truly to another place, there must be not one, but three acts of imagination. This man who will take your eyes, fly to the moon, and feed them to moon owls. In other words, to create the reality of the imagination, you have to go two steps beyond the lie, into what you were calling the...
You're right. But in that story that you've just given to me, the as you add lie upon lie upon lie, and the bigness of the lie increases, it doesn't decrease, the logic of the story becomes firmer.
Yes, exactly.
As soon as you realize that there are owls on the moon, that's the explanation for the depth of the eyes. We know that all those individual stories are nonsense, but there's a kind of an internal organic sense to a story that you push to into its final chamber.
But let's look further. I'm talking to Jim Crace, the author of Quarantine. We're talking at the moment about a hypothetical example of how one makes the realism of fantasy, but it's the same question as how one makes in fiction the realism of Christ.
Yeah.
If we think for a moment about taking the eyeballs, well, what's the other element of the recipe? That it be visceral.
Mm-hmm.
We're given in this book, in your desert, the pain of the earth, that even the lizards hop on it lightly, keep one leg up. They don't land precisely on the hot ground. The visceral. Then the abstract. These moon owls that eat eyes. Well, owls are the figures of knowledge, and the eyes are how knowledge enters. So obviously they're eating not food, but vision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be the story here, too. We're going to be learning about the reality of how a man has visions and how visions transform into real actions. This is the essence of fiction's logic, it seems to me.
Mm. Well, that what you're saying is true, but in a way, as a method of working, it would be disastrous. because this is wisdom after the event.
Mm-hmm.
This is the effect that you hope to have. As you were talking, I was thinking, God, how could I ever write another sentence if I knew that that was the package I was carrying?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you couldn't, because you can't fake it. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hit the magic note without going through the scales. And I mean, I had a certain methodology with writing about Jesus. I had, for a start, I'm on a very simplistic level. How does anyone write about Jesus? The very word is so loaded with cargo. That just to mention the word is to invite people to think of something other than you're thinking of. So I changed Jesus' name in the book, and I called him the Galilee. He comes from the Galilee, and that was a very liberating thing.
Well, you call him Jesus very early on.
Early on, you have to establish that that's who he is, and he has it a couple of times. So there was a whole series of things that I did in that way. It helps being an atheist, of course, writing about mm-hmm. Christ, because you don't have any preconceptions. It helps the fact that if you look at the Western canon's representation of what Christ is, they show him as a blonde, good-looking fellow with a beard. Well, we know he wasn't that. We know that he was from the Near East and that he would be swarthy and dark-skinned. So all of those things help you to invent a Christ. Now, once you've done that, once you're starting to be free of the cliched image of what Christ is according to the Christian religion, You then find yourself, or I find myself, free to reinterpret anything that associates itself with him, without seeming to be disrespectful. So I was able to have a new look at the reality of his miracles, have a new look at the kind of background he had, to see what sort of person he would be to have entered into that kind of ministry. But most important of all, the gap that I'm describing allows you to impose on a story which is 2,000 years ago, 20th century sensibilities. And for me, this was the most important worry in the book as I was writing it, that what I did not want to write was an historical resurrection of what it was really like 2,000 years ago, because I'm not interested in that. What I was interested in doing was freeing myself up sufficiently to put that story under 20th century pressure. The real essence of the book, the challenge of the book was for me, given my starting point as being a scientific atheist, and given the fact that if you went into any desert for 40 days and didn't have food and drink, you would die. Now, the challenge to the book is that we know, so Christ goes in the desert for quarantine, he dies after 30 days. How do we then get the Christian religion back out of that? So the challenge for me was to come up with some rational, imaginative, ambiguous set of narratives, which would one and the same time do these things: kill Jesus off after 30 days, and rob the 20th century of 2,000 years of Christianity, rob us of the Christian ministry, rob us of the Bible stories, rob us of the crucifixion. Or to present us with an alternative interpretation which will allow Christ to have been resurrected after his fast, his fatal fast. And those are the two things which the book gives you at the end. And it provides a satisfactory route for atheists and a satisfactory salve for believers. And it's ambiguous, and that's the way books work best, I think. Because if you at the end, it's the Musa figure who is the one who goes down from the hills of Judea believing in the Godhead of Christ and believing that Christ has been resurrected. And so no one can be made happy out of this. The irony for the Christians who read the book is that if they want to believe that Christ is resurrected, then Christ is a gift of the devil. And it's a very 20th century retake of the old theologies.
I've been speaking to Jim Crace, whose most recent novel, Quarantine, has recently been published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We're speaking under the auspices of the British Council in Cambridge, England. Thank you for spending the time with me.
Michael, I've enjoyed it.
My name is Michael Silverblatt. As said, I'm taping in a dormitory room at Downing College. The show is Bookworm. Thank you very much for joining me.
To the jungles you can go in
bus. Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.